Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Henri Barkey, who's the director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He served as a member of the United States Department of State's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Barkey.
Thank you.
And it looks as though the yes vote in the referendum in Turkey has narrowly won. At this point, what are the latest? Do you know, Henri, in terms of the percentage?
It's very confusing because the results are being contested in the sense that it's not clear whether or not the Supreme Electoral Council has officially announced them because the way the Turkish system works, I mean, they announce the number of the percentage of ballots boxes that have been opened, and there seems to be some disagreement as to whether or not those numbers are correct or not. This election, I mean, Erdogan will probably claim, I mean, he has already claimed victory, but this is a really dark day for Turkey. This is the first time since 1946 that a Turkish election or referendum has been marred by suspicion, by a really very large cloud of suspicion, and the results are going to be seen as being illegitimate, and I think this is not the victory that Erdogan was hoping. He invested a great deal into this. All of the state resources were poured into supporting his position. People who were opposed to him were not allowed to campaign. They were not allowed to put posters up. They were accused of being traitors. They were accused of being supporters of the West, supporters of to all of Turkey's enemies. So under these circumstances, it is the fact that the no vote is so high. I mean, and this is the acknowledged no vote. There are also enormous numbers of videos coming out where very suspicious activities were observed, like officials stamping ballots for in favor of the government, and so we don't know how extensive some of these suspicious activities were. But whatever it is, the fact that this is a razor-thin majority, the fact that people don't trust the results, the fact that with all the pressure, the no vote managed to be so large means that in reality, probably the no vote won, and Erdogan knows it. And this is not going to be easy for him. I mean, he will make the most out of it, but the fact of the matter is that he's going to be an illegitimate president, and that's going to cast a shadow over his presidency.
Well, clearly the coup, or the aborted coup, failed coup that took place recently, indicated resistance to him in no uncertain manner, but it ended up backfiring in his favor.
Well, I wouldn't put too much credence on that coup. I mean, that coup was not very extensive. That coup was done by very, very few people. In fact, there were very few soldiers who were out on the streets at night, and most of them thought they were going on maneuvers. They didn't realize they were engaged in a coup. That coup is very suspicious in terms of its origins. We do not really know who instigated it, despite what the government says. So that coup was not the result of some popular movement in Turkey. But you're right about the following, that he used and milked the coup to essentially maneuver for this referendum result. I mean, all of the campaign by the government was also based on, if you want to support the regime against those who wanted to do a coup, then you vote yes, although the logic doesn't make sense. Nonetheless, I mean, they milked the coup, and in general, the people's opposition to the coup as a means of getting support for the referendum. And even, you know, that's an interesting point you make, you bring up, in the sense that you've had this amazing gift from God, as Erdogan said, in terms of a failed coup, and yet with the legitimacy that was conferred by the coup, he still couldn't get a resounding victory here. And four of the largest cities of Turkey voted against him. And so the countryside votes are a little bit, are very suspicious, because there was no, in many places, the only poll watchers were members of the AKP, the ruling party, Erdogan's party. And look, one of the most important opposition leaders is in jail. Has not been, you know, has not, he's in jail in trumped up charges, as I think 10 other members of parliament from his party. There's 150 journalists in prison. Hundreds of journalists have already been fired, and all of course, opposition journalists. Newspapers have been taken over. The press is 90% controlled by Erdogan, directly or indirectly. With all these advantages, he still could not get a resounding yes vote. I mean, I thought that he would not be able to cheat in a massive scale, and that the no vote would eke out. I wrote in a Washington Post column this week that there is a tendency among Turks that when somebody tells you have to do this, they vote against you. And we've seen this historically in many after coup attempts, or after successful coups. Every time the generals took over, in the first election after the generals decide to leave power, people vote en masse against the party that was seen to have been victimized by the coup attempt. And in fact, Erdogan, to some extent, owes his own success at the polls in the early 2000s to a military intervention in 1997 that got rid of the party that he was associated with. But then he broke away from it, and kicked that party out of power. So Erdogan's victory, in some ways, was helped by the military's missteps, mm-hmm. right? But mm-hmm. the reason is because people don't like interference in the politics, and a lot of people who may have been sympathetic to Erdogan, who may like Erdogan, still voted against him, I think, including members of his own party, because they probably resented the way they were pushing this vote down people's throats.
What about then the dispute over the unstamped ballots? You mentioned earlier, probably in the rural areas. And by the way, that sort of makes me think perhaps there is some analogy here with the United States, because there's no question that the American people in the urban areas, they vote Democratic, and in the rural areas, they vote Republican, and the Republicans have massively gerrymandered. Is there a case that you have sort of the red state versus the blue state dichotomy in Turkey, as we have here, where the more religious, less educated people voted for Trump, the strong leader, the man on a white horse, and likewise, it's happening today in Turkey?
No. I mean, first of all, in the United States, there is no fraud in elections. I mean, Trump won because he won the majority of the states with the requisite electoral votes, even though Hillary got 3 million votes more than he did. But that's the way the system works here. And I think the comparison would be unfair to the United States, because here we have no example or proof that there was any vote rigging or anything like that. In Turkey, too, historically, there's never been any vote rigging. Never. I mean, I've always thought that the one thing that the Turks have gotten right consistently was their electoral system. And it was an electoral system that everybody trusted. Nobody ever questioned it. I don't remember elections being questioned like this, like they are being today. Right? And then another reason, by the way, the comparison doesn't fit, is because in Turkey you have this ethnic division, and part of the rural areas, the Kurdish areas, voted against Erdogan. But there are many reports, even from the Kurdish regions, where village headmen essentially blocked their constituents from voting and voted for them. We don't know. I mean, there's going to be a lot of contestation in the weeks to come. It's not going to change anything, because the government won't let it, won't allow it, because, you know, this is a do-or-die issue for this government. They cannot accept the fact that they, or we cheated. But in any way, the fact that the atmosphere in which this referendum was held was blatantly unfair. When you were being accused, if you wanted to vote against, you were accused of being a traitor to the country. You were accused of being siding with the West against Turkey, or siding against Turkey in allegiance in cahoots with the PKK, with the all kinds of enemies, Daesh. I mean, anybody whose enemy they decided was fair game in terms of using it as to denounce the opposition. And when you don't let opposition leaders campaign, right, and when you don't let the opposition put even signs up, and people get arrested for putting no signs, I mean, that's not a fair election. I mean, it doesn't matter. I mean, and remember, that creates an atmosphere of intimidation, because people, you know, even people who want to vote no may go and cast a spoiled ballot or vote yes because they're afraid, because they think that somehow the government will know how they voted. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the fear of the government, the almighty state, I should say, is actually quite prevalent in Turkey. So, you know, this is, I mean, the other problem for Turkey, or for Erdogan, I should say, is that, he can try to convince and the Turkish public that this was a fair and, you know, he wanted clean and fair. Nobody in the rest of the world believes that.
Sure.
Right? So next time he sees a European leader or an American leader, he's damaged goods.
Right. Well, of course, he stoked anti-European fervor, and a lot of the people that voted for him were angry at the outside world. So I don't know how that can turn around. And I take your point that there's no comparison in the terms of the elections between the U.S. and Russia, the U.S. and Turkey. But is there a comparison, though, with Donald Trump and Erdogan in terms of their massive egos? I mean, this guy, Erdogan, seems to be a total megalomaniac, and he sees himself as Turkey's new sultan, and now he can rule until 2029.
Actually, longer than that. There's a loophole in that constitutional referendum that allows him to run, actually, at least until 2033. So in fact, it's very carefully, this is a loophole that many people missed. And there are a couple of very interesting loopholes that expand his powers in ways in which the Turkish public did not pay attention to. I mean, some of them look minor, like two words in one article of the Constitution that completely change the balance in terms of one of the institutions that respond to, that is under the control of the president. I don't want to go into the details. It's kind of in the weeds a little bit. But so there are many loopholes, and one of them is the fact that he, although he's limited to two terms after 2019, the loophole allows him to actually run for a third term under certain circumstances, which he will definitely avail himself of. So he's going to be there at least until 2033, which means that he probably will be in power continuously in Turkey for 30 years, from 2003 to 2033. That's 30 years. That's going to be, most Turks will have lived under him and will have known only one leader. And that's what he wants.
Well, just in the last minute then, Henri Barki, I'm astounded, though, that people in Turkey, I mean, I know this, you're suggesting that probably more people voted against him than they voted for him, but because of how he controls the press and they stamped out the opposition, he can rig the vote for the first time. But nevertheless, in the broadest sense, his policies have failed. He started out with a policy of zero problems with neighbors. Now he's got nothing but problems with neighbors. His policies towards Syria are completely failed. His military adventurism has failed. Now he's got more jihadist cells. He let them in, and now they're blowing up all around the place in Turkey. He's got fights with his neighbors. He started a war with the Kurds again, and he's also driven down tourism. It's declined by 30%, and that's a big source of revenue. So I'm just astounded that people can't. And this guy says he's going to. No. You vote for me, and things will get better, and the economy will get better. And well, he's.
But no, no, but no, but he, I mean, here's I think the mistake that people will make. Erdogan is also genuinely popular because he actually, especially the first 5 years of his rule, between 2003 2008, he ran the country admirably. I mean, he did everything right. He in terms of domestic reforms, in terms of making life easier for Turks, especially in healthcare. I mean, his reforms really changed Turkey. I mean, I thought, you know, in 2008, if I was a Turkish citizen, I would have voted for him too, because, I mean, he genuinely improved a lot of this country. And Turkey also has grown tremendously in the years he's been in power. It's not all due to him, because the reforms that were introduced before he came to power helped him a great deal. But at least he didn't mess up those reforms, which other Turkish politicians have done routinely. So he took an economy that was on the brink of a breakthrough and helped it along. And in terms of infrastructure, in terms of, I mean, he's done a great deal. I mean, we should not underestimate his. And look, the fact that the Syria policy is a failure, the Syria policy is a failure for everybody. It's not just Erdogan. It's for Obama, Trump is too early. For everybody has lost in Syria. It's a no-win situation. So we can't blame him for the Arab Spring. And at the beginning of the Arab Spring, he seemed to be on top of things. Did he make mistakes? Of course he made mistakes. But what happened is that after 2008, that's when his megalomania starts to appear, and he seems to think of himself as essentially a leader of the Turks forever. And and it's true, we're going to see from now on an attempt by him to actually try to increase his influence abroad, especially in the Middle East, try to become, assume the leadership of the Middle East. But this referendum is going to really taint and it's going to hamper these efforts.
Well, Henri Barkey, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Henri Barkey. He's the director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center of Scholars. He served as the U.S. State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East and the Eastern Mediterranean and intelligence. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.